The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to The Fandom Files. We're a Sci-Fi Wire podcast about people who really, really love stuff. I'm Jordan Zacharin, the features editor here at Sci-Fi, and I'm joined by my good pal and co-host, Emily Gaudet, who is an editor at Contently. Emily, what's up? I haven't seen you in, it feels like, months. You've, like, been doing peyote in the desert or woods or wherever.
No, but yeah, peyote is a desert drug.
Okay.
Thank you. People tend to do mushrooms or molly in
people.
The woods. I'm
With
not committing
people.
To anything. I'm just saying people.
Oh, some
people do it.
Yeah. You may or may not know them.
Yeah.
Where have you, like, I don't know where you've been.
And
you weren't missing.
Oh, like, yeah.
Clear,
yeah.
I knew you were traveling.
You knew where I was. Yeah. You knew that I was not here. Right. Yeah, I was, I was at the beach for a weekend, and then I was in San Francisco, and then up in the Redwoods for a wedding, which is where said drugs may happen.
You, like, saw some nymphs and gnomes get married.
I did. I saw, like, a forest nymph get married to a bearded man who, like, hand makes knives.
Wow.
Yeah. It was amazing.
How'd you get invited to that?
My boyfriend.
Okay, yeah, he knows all the
Yeah,
gnomes.
Yeah. I totally wore, like, the wrong dress too. Cause I what do you wear to that? I don't know.
I don't know.
So I went 50s. Like, if someone tells me to, like, go a little formal, I tend to go
like a sock hop.
No, like a polka dot Betty Draper dress. Cause I'm a curvy woman.
Okay.
And, like, that's curvy women tend to wear 50s clothing
because
it makes us look better. But this was very much like a floaty California. Everyone was wearing, like, a little bit of fabric that just kind of flowed around them.
That sounds terrible.
It was. They looked beautiful, but I definitely looked out of place. And then this past weekend, I was in rural Montreal. No, rural Quebec, which is 2 hours from Montreal.
From Montreal.
Yeah, which is, like, indistinguishable from Alabama, except everyone speaks French.
That's where you have family there?
Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
Yeah, my grandpa grew up there.
Oui. That's French.
Yeah.
Do you speak any French?
Enough that I can, like, argue at the airport, but yeah.
Did your family speak English?
No. My family mostly speaks French. They can kind of, like, communicate with us, but when I was a kid, it used to be, like, play with your cousins, and they would sit all my English-speaking American cousins with, like, our backwoods French cousins in a room.
Force you to fight.
Ahead. Yeah. We had a conversation once. A long one. We were talking about jet skis, and our cousins were like, ski-doos. We were like, what?
Ski-doos.
They were calling them ski-doos.
Well, that sounds like a fun summer of trips.
Yeah, speaking of trips, aren't you going somewhere?
Yes, actually, in like 12 hours or so, I'm leaving for Walt Disney World.
Are you even going to sleep?
Not that much. Julie and I are going down for the opening of Toy Story Land. She's going to be my photographer. She doesn't need a camera.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I'm very excited, and we're going to do actually a whole episode of the podcast down there, and it'll probably come out before this one. But I feel, like, terribly guilty. The world is falling apart. Like, Anthony Kennedy just retired, and they're going to put, I think, like, Mussolini on the bench. They're going to resurrect Mussolini and put him on the Supreme Court and call him like a centrist. Be like, oh, he's more moderate. And they just, you know, killed unions for, you know, and there's kids in cages.
Yeah,
you know, so
it's,
I feel,
been a terrible
weird
week.
Going down to Disney World and being like, well, no problems here.
Yeah, I mean, I think even weirder is going to be all the people at Disney who don't give a shit at all.
Yeah, that's true. Like, I'm going to be the wokest person at Disney World.
Probably.
I want to get a shirt that says that.
You deserve, like, ice cream in your face for that. Like, yeah.
That would be the absolute. I would really.
Mickey Mouse should just give you a noogie.
Yeah, I would deserve that. No, I'm very excited. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And, like, it is for work. I'm not just saying, like, screw it, going down there.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking. Julia's never been, so.
Ever?
No.
Whoa.
She went to Disneyland once when she was a little
kid. Oh, the lesser of the two.
Well, she was like 11 and they were in LA. But
oh, yeah. No, I'm not judging her. Well, I'm just saying.
She said her family always went on, like, adult vacations. Her parents went on, like, adult vacations and, like, forced them to go along.
Oh, that's fair.
Yeah. Like, they would go, like, camping in, like, somewhere, or they'd go to some other city. and it would be like, you know, she'd be just forced to go with her sisters.
Like cultured people.
Yeah.
I went to Disney because my grandpa was wealthy and I was his first grandchild.
You go all the time.
No, I did. Yeah. I went like every summer-ish when I was like 1 through 5. And then we went on my dad's dime and the government's dime after the first Gulf War because my dad was... In the second Gulf War, sorry. My dad was in both, but the second Gulf War, they were handing out trips to Disney to all the veterans' families.
Like, oh, sorry about that.
Yeah, and it was like, yeah, exactly, like, our bed. And then, but we were treated like kings. We, like, stayed in the Animal Kingdom Lodge.
Wow.
Where are you staying?
First night is Yacht Club.
Is that nice?
That's, like, apparently really nice. Never been.
Ooh.
But then the next one is Pop Century, which is supposedly cool, like a fun
cool.
one.
Cool.
Yeah, I'm very excited to do it. We're only going to be there 4 days. We have to like really, we have so much to fit in.
Yeah, you do.
Because like the first day and a half, we're going to be at Hollywood Studios for Toy Story Land.
Yeah.
Which will be great. But yeah, there's a lot to fit in.
Yeah, in my memory, it's, I would just say like, just be super judicious about souvenirs.
Yeah.
Because they're twice what you think they're going to be. And then it's so easy to get home and be like, oh, I don't care about any of this crap.
Well, I just feel like I have to buy for coworkers because we buy each other stuff.
Yeah.
Then like, you know, a few like quasi niece and nephews. So
yeah,
you know, it's gonna be more for
I just
others.
I remember I bought a pen once and it was $10.
You bought me a light up pen at Disney World.
Yeah, yeah.
And it like has never lit up once.
And you got me a pen where it's Goofy and he has a pair of glasses and when you click it, they go onto his forehead or back onto his eyes. They're really good.
Yeah. So I am looking forward to it. I'll be at the Toy Story Land, which will be
cool.
Fun. Yeah.
Who's gonna be the guest on the podcast?
Oh, we're gonna have an Imagineer and
nice.
Some theme park bloggers.
Nice. Yeah. I was hoping it was like Woody and Buzz.
Goofy. Goofy couldn't make it.
Oh.
Yeah. I keep making up names of places in Disney World, like Goofy's so-and-so emporium. Like Julie was like, I'm gonna have to get sunscreen. I was like, well, Goofy has a sunscreen out there.
She wouldn't know.
Yeah.
You could just make up rides on the way that you definitely want to do.
Yeah. I'm definitely going to the entire time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I also told her that you can rollerblade around the entire park.
It's mandatory, actually. Yeah.
You get a discount.
Whoa!
Well, speaking of Disney, because they own everything.
They do.
Including 20th Century Fox, as of like 5 minutes ago.
Mm-hmm.
Tonight, they also own Star Wars. That's the...
They do.
Yes, they own Star Wars. And we were talking about Star Wars today.
Oh, that's a segue.
That is a segue.
Our guest tonight is Annalisa Filion, a filmmaker who is the director of the docuseries Looking for Leia, which chronicles the world of female Star Wars fans. And there's no more heated fandom to talk about right now than Star Wars fans. Annalisa,
hey.
How's it going?
I'm good. How y'all doing?
Doing well. I'm sorry for the... We had a little bit of technical difficulty before, but...
Yeah.
We have technical greatness now.
Technical great. We've achieved a kind of technical greatness, and I'm feeling really comfortable with that.
Technical nirvana, if you will.
So, tell us what this docu-series is about.
Yeah, so Looking for Leia is a 6-part docu-series about girls and women in Star Wars fandom. So for a little over a year now, we started filming at Celebration in Orlando in 2017, so that was April of last year. I've been sort of zigzagging around the U.S. talking with women about participatory fandom. So the kind of fandom that's not just like, oh, I really like a thing, but I like a thing so much I'm going to do something about it.
Mm.
And it's been an amazing project. You know, like there's a level on which we're elevating a group of fans whose voices are often not focused on or heard. And then there's also a way in which we're just shifting the lens through which we talk about participatory fandoms. And instead of talking about it from a kind of specifically male point of view, which is the default, we're bringing a lot of different points of view to the table. And I like to kind of jokingly say we're going to femsplain Star Wars fandom. And I think it makes for a really nice entry point, particularly now. Like, you know, there's when you're working on a project that's adjacent to Star Wars in any way, I think you're always going to be doing something pretty timely. And it's been interesting to watch how the timeliness of this project has shifted and grown over the year that it's been in production.
You know, I'm looking forward to seeing this as a double feature along with the Last Jedi remake that those guys are making.
Oh my God.
Well, you know, my favorite, there were so many things that I loved about that, but my favorite was when you read the fine print, because, you know, clearly I was procrastinating and not wanting to do the mountain of actual film work that people who are actually making films are doing. but they were also raising all this fake money from all their fake pledges to give to Disney remake the film themselves. Right? I was really just like, oh, that is literally not how film production works, but you guys are cute.
Yeah. It's like, I remember at one point, so for our listeners, if they haven't heard about this somehow, what happened was, apparently, there's been a lot of people who, when I say a lot of people, I mean a lot of a certain kind of dork. A few really loud people who did not like The Last Jedi because we could either believe them when they say it's because they didn't like the way Luke was treated and they don't like the hero's journey. I don't even know what they're saying, but they're just like racist, sexist doofuses. Mm-hmm. and the thing didn't match up to the thing that they, you know, loved as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
That's aggressive of me to say, and I don't want to put words on Elise's mouth, but ultimately that's kind of the case. And so they pledged, and you know, some people didn't like the movie because they didn't like the movie, and that's fine.
Yeah,
I mean, certainly
I didn't
has,
really like
yeah, it has some flaws, but I don't think that's why you didn't like the movie. I mean, it's a long
cool
movie.
With the women.
Yeah,
That'd be great.
It's a long movie. There's a lot going on. Maybe some things last too long, whatever it is. But that's generally not the reason a lot of these guys don't like it, if Kelly Marie Tran's Instagram is to be believed.
Mm-hmm.
And so they decided they are going to propose to Disney that they will remake The Last Jedi. Pick a director. And they're going to write it as a community, as a group.
Ew, oh, God.
And they were raising kind of like funny money for it, like pledges. Like, I could just go and say, yeah, I'll give you $1 million if you make this happen.
Right.
I mean, Disney, you know, Ryan Johnson kind of jokingly said, please, 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 please on Twitter.
Yeah.
Like, let it happen. But it's like the latest volley. And actually, no, someone decided today they were going to protest Disney. They had like a Star Wars fan Bill of Rights or something. So it's been like an insane time. For Star Wars fans.
Well, and it's, you know, this is the tricky thing, is that this is a very broad brush, right? Fandom in general is a very broad brush. And then I think that the advent of the internet and the way that social media works to give us a sometimes inaccurate sense of the groups we're actually talking about, right? Because it's a filter and a lens.
Mm-hmm.
And you're getting to see very specific things. And of course, like a group of boys describing themselves as filmmakers, doing the opposite of filmmaking and making a whole lot of kerfuffle about it is just delightful. It's amusing and it's super clickbait worthy. So absolutely, this is going to become a thing that everyone's talking about, right? There was like a glorious 3 hours in which that was just the only thing on my Twitter feed. And, you know, like we all had one of those good cry laughs where you're like, oh God, I needed that. Thank you. And they kind of moved on to our days. But I don't actually believe that, that this is a representation of fandom. I think that what is true is that there are some really vocal groups in all fandoms. And I would, you know, I would certainly look to things like sports fandom for this. Like you will always get groups of impassioned people. Most of fandom is a unified sort of social group brought together by a thing they collectively love and enjoy and are passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
Some parts of fandom, there's always some sort of like outlier in fandom that's a group of folks who just really love to dislike a thing. It might serve a similar psychological purpose. It definitely has a different output. And so it's been interesting for me, you know, when I started looking for Leia, all of the press questions I got, because we started it in 2017, we were kind of, you know, Last Jedi hadn't come out yet. We were still just kind of like getting around the fact that Rey was the protagonist. Every media question, why do you think women are now into Star Wars? And so I would answer every media question with this, like, you know, very mansplaining, well, actually, women have always been a part of, you know, not just Star Wars fandom, but in fact, genre fandom. And I was kind of always doing this history lesson. And of course, in the last couple of months, the only press question I get is, why are Star Wars fans so toxic? No one asks me about why women are suddenly into Star Wars anymore. We've shifted. Mm. And it's an understandable question because certainly there's a group of folks within this particular fandom that are acting out in some very dramatic and splashy ways. But I also think that they're acting out in a way that is extremely aligned with a thing that we're seeing across domains in this country right now. And that's actually very frightening and maybe not terribly comfortable to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the rise of white supremacy and neo-fascism and like deeply troubling, challenging, world-shifting changes in social order and social structure. And I think that shows up across domains. And if I were, faced with having to talk about the rise of neo-fascism and white supremacy, or a bunch of fanboys really like spouting a ton of misogynist and racist rhetoric, I'd probably want to talk about Star Wars too. It's easier to get your head around. But I think that that most vehement, most poisonous voice is actually not Star Wars specific or Dodgers specific or, school specific. And we don't ask these questions of why does it happen in this one domain? I think it's a broader question of what's going on right now, that there's a particular group of people who across all of these different platforms are acting out in such vicious ways right now.
Yeah, it's certainly, it's a silly expression of a very serious topic or very serious thing that's happening. And I also think that just being in the business that Emily and I are in, business, it's like, I think a lot of people who cover entertainment are smart, passionate, liberal people. And to tackle this very stupid idea of these people remaking this movie for what are basically, or attacking Kelly Marie Tran's Instagram is basically a way to cover what's happening in the country, by proxy even.
Yeah, definitely.
So I think
And where it becomes a parallel process, unfortunately, with also we're going to cover this because we can't kind of cover the big thing, is that we do end up then treating these things as separate phenomena. Mm-hmm. And I do think we at some level need to look at it as a linked project because we have to fix this.
Sure.
Right? This is actually kind of scary stuff. And, we can laugh a lot about the quality of discourse. And I think certainly this remake notion is a particularly silly one. But I've gotten my first death threats this spring. I was interviewing my last round of pickups in Los Angeles a few weeks ago, and the conversation that was happening with most of the folks that were coming to the camera was about their experience of being viciously, vigorously harassed and receiving death threats. Oh. And this is not, I think, normal, right? This is the refrain we've been saying since the election. This is not normal. And when I get these things, when other women are getting these things, it's not at the level of doxing, which I'm very grateful for right now. It feels kind of casual and flippant. But in this way, too, that I'm like, wow, you're just reeling these things off. This is just this easy thing for you to type without any real awareness of the fact that it's hitting another person on the other end, on the receiving end. So I do think there's something, more nefarious. And we see it raise its head, right? We had it with Gamergate, and we've got it in comics right now. And there are these pockets of the overused term of toxic masculinity. Mm-hmm. And I do think it's a conversation that needs to happen. And we need to be able to have it without the first place we go having to be this not all men space.
Right.
Guys should be just as horrified as anyone else. This guy should be as horrified about this as anyone else. And a part of undoing the problem is to not get into that defensive space, but to just show which side you're on and really get in there to undo it.
Well, I'm a straight white guy.
Which is a nice segue for getting behind projects that elevate underrepresented fanboys.
Sure. the interesting thing about...
I turn that around to a nice positive way.
No. speaking of the death threat thing, what are they asking, what are they asking you to do in order to not be killed? I mean, obviously it's hopefully very, very empty, but what is it? Don't make a documentary? About people who...
No, it's not even that. It's not even that. It's a long tirade of name calling and just general threats. It's not even a ransom letter. There's not even an ask on the other end of it. It's that sort of these are the terrible things that are going to happen to you. And again, I think there are certain groups of folks that actually live with a pretty constant level of threat or harassment. Mm-hmm. Just as a part of daily life. And you sometimes become, I think, a little inert to how much energy and resources you have. Most women of both cis and trans experience know what it's like to just have to be a little extra vigilant walking down the street. And then that gets compounded if you're a little gender conforming, if you're a woman of color. It gets compounded if you're more visible. So we all, we know how to do this. It's not these things strike us as oh my God, this is this is such a like frighteningly new experience. It's more like a, wow, I devote a lot of time and energy to this. Imagine if those resources were freed up, how much more productive I might be able to be in society if I didn't have to allocate a certain amount of energy to taking hits like that.
You know, that reminds me, another thing that women know how to do is enjoy and watch a story that's about someone who doesn't look like them, because that's what we did our entire lives.
Absolutely.
So now we're asking white male fans to just watch a story where the protagonist happens to be a woman or a woman of color, and that is such an alien thing for them that they feel like something has been taken.
Yeah. Camille Nanjiani made that wonderful comment after the last award season about like, hey, y'all, I've been watching stories about like white, you know, sort of like Western European folks my entire life, and I've managed to do it fine. Like you can hop that track and watch a story about my life. And in fact, I think we're better for it. You know, like outsiders have amazing perspectives because we've grown up and learned about ourselves and others through having to adapt in a lot of ways. The stories that we read, because we don't get ourselves represented. And so I think it's great for folks who've enjoyed kind of majority culture to step outside of that and just listen to a story of something that's other than their own. Mm-hmm. And my hope is that it's also great for folks who've just chronically not seen themselves to be able to sit down and actually like witness a thing that's made really by and about them and folks who are like them.
You know, I used to watch, and I used to cover indie film more, and I watched a lot of indie film because of it. And if I saw another movie about a sad white guy, which like I generally am a sad white guy,
Zach Braff.
But yeah, so I got, you know,
the SWG acronym for this, because this is lovely.
Yeah. And so, you know, I've seen so many of them and I kind of know exactly what's going to happen in it. And so when I go see like a movie such as Sorry to Bother You or Blindspotting, which I saw the last 2 weeks, that about, you know, black men or different communities, that's so much more interesting to me at this point.
Yeah.
Anyways, and that's not even, you know, a Star Wars or superheroes, any kind of movie.
Yeah. It's, you know, we've oversaturated some columns, right? And so it's not to say that these are bad stories. It's to say we've just, they're really overrepresented. Those columns are oversaturated. As a storyteller, I'm less interested in telling them. Mm-hmm. They're not worthless. They're not bad. They've just been told at such a disproportionate rate to the stories that haven't been told, that I'm all about elevating those stories and those storytellers who've not really gotten the seat at the table.
So in addition to being a documentarian, you are also a clinical therapist, right? So what role do you think that fandom can play positively for people, maybe if they're dealing with mental health issues? Like when is the escape helpful and when does it hinder them?
Well, you know, it's been interesting working on this project and having that kind of clinical lens, and also speaking with other clinicians in front of the camera who've given their own sort of observations on this. But in my experience, I've seen fandom as being used in these incredibly creative, robust, and contributive ways in people's lives. And so, like, one of the things that I have seen over and over again is the way that fandom serves a real curative role for social anxiety and for, you know, social anxiety that can run the gamut from stuff that isn't, like, terribly impeding on your ability to, like, hold a job and function to the stuff that actually is, like, really debilitating and really keeps you from being able to, like, interact with and engage with the world. So I've talked with folks that have such kind of profound social phobia and social anxiety that it's difficult for them to be able to do anything around other folks, but they can go and stand in line for Star Wars films. They can go to cons. They can go and be in a crowded theater with other folks to watch these stories, because the love of story is so unifying and it creates this kind of safe bubble. There's a huge amount of, I think, clinically appropriate escapism that provides relief from depression and relief from, you know, especially these days, we've got a lot of people's complex PTSD being kicked up by just the world around them. There's something very soothing about being able to step slightly outside of your daily life and enjoy a story as a form of positive escapism. Not that you're actually going into a state of clinical denial, because the other thing I think we see a lot is that people in fandom are acutely aware of the fact that these stories don't happen in reality. These are fictional stories. we get that the aliens and the spaceships and the long time ago is all a part of a fictional narrative.
What?
But it's a fictional narrative with a tremendous purpose. And also a lot of the ways that folks kind of dream and inspire their own identity formation, the way that they're able to connect to and have relationships with others. Connection and relationship has actually come up as a theme in so many of these interviews. And I find it interesting because it's so contrary to the stereotype we have of particularly fan boys, right? Which is this like maladjusted person living in isolation in their mother's basement. Mm-hmm. And I would say 99% of the interviews that I've done, and I've got like, I think at this point, over 87 individual interviews with women from all over the place. This is like, you know, a lot of footage. The way that fandom is used to build connection and relate to others comes up as a theme over and over again.
You know, it makes me wonder about people who are doing this. You know, they like the movie you're doing is in a way its own sort of activism, and people use they push for representation in Star Wars and other things, and then they use movies and fandom in a very negative way. So why do you think people channel their either their prejudices or their hopes through fandom and the franchises they love as well?
Well, I have a hunch about the folks that are sort of acting out in the most sort of toxic and hostile ways in fandom right now. But fandom is not the only site upon which this kind of action happens.
Sure.
My hunch is that if you had a chance to actually see this person in the full context of their lives, there'd be some pretty deep maladjustments happening in a lot of other domains as well. I think that because of social media, because of the way that it is public, because of the way it can amplify a minority of voices and it can amplify the impact of those voices, it seems a little bigger than it is. It becomes kind of, you know, the great and powerful Oz, when in fact it is probably a 12-year-old behind the curtain. But I'm really concerned about that 12-year-old. Like, I'm really concerned about, like, what are the rest of the interactions like? If the sort of, you know, and I do identify a lot of the hostility and the anger and the brittle fragility as being adolescent and being a sort of developmental stage that we want folks to successfully navigate through and beyond. But I think that fandom is one domain where you see it. I think that there's something much more specific around empathy and relatedness to others that's certainly lacking there. And if we got to see this person in these people, all six of them, in the full context of their lives, I think we'd probably see that show up a lot.
You know, what's interesting is during the 2016 election, a lot of people scoffed and then asserted about the economic anxiety that led to, you know, quote-unquote economic anxiety that led to the Trump victory. And I think, obviously, a lot of it was just blanket meanness, but I think there was something true about there being economic anxiety, and when people feel anxious and out of control, they want to lash out and grab control back. And I don't know, do you think that the people who are, again, this is just a small percentage of toxic fans, but they have other things in their lives, or they feel like out of control from, you know, the rest of the real world, or they don't have economic opportunity, or whatever it is that makes them feel extra possessive of these sort of imaginary worlds?
I mean, I definitely appreciate psychologically kind of like how that argument fits. Where it falls apart for me is there are huge groups of folks that we tend to call the minority, but statistically speaking, actually, we are the minority. So if you take women and then like intersect all of these groups, queer folks, trans folks, non-binary folks, folks of color, disabled folks, immigrant folks, and you put us all in a big group, we have all lived with an incredibly high degree of anxiety and fear, and we've managed to not seek to sort of systemically lash out at and harm others.
Right.
So I think that humans are perfectly capable of experiencing anxiety and fear of loss without enacting hostility and violence. I think what we're seeing is the way that deeply held beliefs about supremacy and entitlement go into attack mode. They go into offensive mode. This is not a defensive mode. It is an offensive mode when the structures that provide for that entitlement feel threatened.
They're,
and that's,
the real,
I think, more accurately what's going on.
Yeah, the white guys are the real snowflakes here.
Yeah, it cracks me up. I'm like, and it's, you know, this is the gaslighting technique, and we are in this, like, the rule of the land is that kind of like I am rubber and you are glue thing right now, which right. is just mesmerizing to watch. But, you know, in that same way that you, if you want to know what Trump is doing, listen to what he says other people are doing. That's likely what he's doing himself, right? And that's how he ran that entire election. And whatever kind of critiques and names the group of folks tend to toss out, I think does often reflect them. It says a lot about these guys cuckolding fantasies, and I'm going to just leave that on the table. But there's a thing there where I'm like, all right, guys, we hear you.
So, you know, going, I mean, I 100% agree. And like looking towards the movie, you've said you've talked to like upwards of 90 people now, and you know,
my editor is like, you have to stop. They're really about to like chain me to the desk.
You know, and
leave the house again. Leave the camera at home.
It's funny that, you know, and it's very true that you said women liked Star Wars before they made Rey the protagonist. You know, and that's a big part of your findings. And so, what have you been told? What kind of stories have you been told about how women fell into loving Star Wars? And I imagine it's mostly just they watched it as kids, like anyone else. But what kind of special relationships have you found there for the film?
They're amazing, and they're so generationally defined. So, you know, we're at the kind of 41-year point with this franchise right now. It's, you know, I chose Star Wars in part because I love me some Star Wars, and so it's always great to be able to do this around the thing you've got personal connection to. And also, it's a really unique franchise, like beyond even Star Trek fandom. I think about a few other, like Doctor Who fandom. There's some really powerful franchise fandoms. You can do multiple stories around Star Wars and still not have nearly enough space to tell the story. And every generation at this point has a Star Wars story. Mm-hmm. So
Solo.
I'm personally Solo. Compelled. Like I'm 45 years old. I saw the first film in the theater when I was a kid, in 1977. The following summer, I saw it like 10 times, and you know, every week basically, I saw the A New Hope, which we called Star Wars back right. in the day. And so it's always been a part of my own. It's always been a part of my life. Right, my earliest conscious memories included my love of Star Wars. I love talking with women who were in their 20s in 1977 and came to Star Wars fandom out of Trek fandom, came out of this amazing history of women's fanzine culture, which is this robust history of women produced, edited, published, and created content. That again started with Trek fandom and moved into Star Wars fandom to the point that between 1977 and 1983, during the kind of original trilogy years, there were upwards of 1,000 of these fanzines in print.
Wow.
They were dense, some of them hundreds of pages, very few pictures, wall-to-wall text. They were fan fiction and theories and letter zines, right? These just huge amounts of content, 95% of it created by, edited by women. And I've had some access to see like slivers of these archives. One of the women who we feature in the series, Maggie Novikoska, has this basement office in her home in Seattle. And going through the hundreds and hundreds of issues of these fanzines, it's this huge hidden fan history that is also deeply generative that I had no idea about before I started work on the project. And I don't think many people actually get to see the intensity with which women's fandom showed up. And also the way, my own observation is the way that letter zines functioned in the 70s and 80s, which was a kind of proto-Twitter, with all the same frustrations, except that sometimes it would take 6 months for your letter to get published and the response to come back, and folks would have fights in these letter scenes. But unlike just getting to have a tiny flame war on Twitter where everything like happens in the course of, you know, like 4.5 minutes, you'd have to wait 6 months gnashing your teeth over what someone thought that they heard you said before wow. you could respond in print to the letter, like, you know, a half a year later. So I love those stories. I love the stories of younger women whose first Star Wars were the prequels, and a lot of women of my generation. You know, the prequels weren't it for me, and they were significant and huge for a generation of girls who grew up with those as their entry point. And I think of this generation often, actually, these days, because the vitriol with which we're dealing with a kind of percentage of toxic fandom right now is something that the prequel generation, they already know how to do that. Right, like they already suffered through all of the fanboys bemoaning how George Lucas raped their childhood, and you know, like this is the most asinine statement in the world. Like this level of really specific guy based hostility. The ask prequel fans how they handle TLJ haters, and they will have something good to tell you because they already went through it once, and they have a lot of collective wisdom, I think, as a fandom in how to navigate that kind of stuff. So I love hearing those stories, and I love the multi-generational stories, the numbers of grandmothers and mothers and daughters and granddaughters who shared this love of Star Wars, and usually adjacent to that, a love of science fiction, which again just sort of pushes back against all of the stereotypes we hold about who a science fiction and fantasy fan is, and that this is something that, you know, people's grandmothers in the 40s and 50s were passing along to them. I find those stories really beautiful, and it feels special to get to document them because I don't see them recorded in that many places.
Yeah, I mean, I was born in 1990. I know that I watched the Star Wars original films with my father before I saw the prequels, but I remember thinking that, I mean, obviously I was not a critic yet, so I wasn't able to analyze Leia for what she was, but I remember thinking, oh, it's just like everything else. There's one woman and she's like a smart ass. Like at that point, I had already seen enough impressions of the Star Wars, like, crew in kids media that I remember thinking, like, well, they put a woman in there for me. Okay. I just wasn't excited about it. And it just blows my mind that we had to wait until these films to have more than one woman, let alone two women having a conversation.
And we've only gotten that in one film.
Yeah. And that was the, like, one that everyone hated.
One film in this entire, and you don't count the animation. The animation routinely passes the Bechdel test, but
yeah,
Jane was the first and only live action Star Wars feature film to pass the Bechdel test.
It's incredible to me. That seems like such a feat. But actually, I'm glad you mentioned the cartoons, because we interviewed members of the Lightsaber Guild, who actually you did too. She's in your teaser, and I love that she mentioned on our podcast, she mentioned that she often teaches little girls whose first and primary experience with Star Wars were these cartoons. Like, they know the characters the way someone like you or I knows Luke and Leia.
Yep.
Which is incredible to me. It's a whole slice of the universe that I've never seen of you.
Those fans are the cartoons.
Heavy. It's cartoons. Content rich. Yeah, we're talking, like, I think there's 7 seasons of the Clone Wars. Like, this is a huge amount of media and a huge amount of storytelling that if you're not, like, keyed, if it's not a thing you've watched, there's a group of folks out there that know this, like, encyclopedic story with more characters and plot points than all of the live action films combined.
Yeah, it was really fun even to see Solo with some kids in the theater, because you could hear them going, and like, I don't know these references.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but they know, you know, they know those names that they would toss off because they're characters in the show.
What I'm curious about is, I mean, I never watched the cartoons because I don't think they came out at the right time for me. I was like in college when they started coming out, or in high school, but I don't think I ever really got into those just because of the timing, but I'm curious, when you talk about the prequels, what do you think, Emily, and what do people in general think about Natalie Portman's character, Padme? Do people relate to her or no?
No, it's just like Qui-Gon Jinn. Like, it's not Natalie Portman's fault. My opinion, there's that great, like, satirical documentary on YouTube about it, where if you ask someone to describe Padme's personality without saying what she looks like, it's like impossible. She's just completely flat like the rest of them. So, I mean, I will say the I was actually watching your previews today, and I was reminded of how gorgeous and complex her costuming was. And that meant something to me, definitely, as a young woman, that she was not, she almost never appeared sexual. There was the one shot in the gladiator thing where she gets her midriff,
right,
like, you know, in the white outfit, it's ripped away, but she the male gaze is like not really that potent in the prequels on her.
She's also very young.
Yeah, true, but she is a little older later, but right, even like the sexual scenes, it's like them as a pair.
Sure.
Which, you know, I mean,
you can't take your eyes off Hayden Christensen.
Yeah, it's just so enigmatic. But yeah, I mean, now we know that that Leia's slave bikini was controversial at the time,
right? Yeah, and you look at Padme, the gigantic Eastern influenced costumes, mm-hmm. that were awesome, kind of preposterous, especially her being from a place that was pretty hot.
True.
Yeah, just overheating.
Not practical.
Yeah, but yeah, she certainly was not.
Fans that were in those dresses. Some of those dresses, you could definitely fit an air conditioning unit.
Yeah, and you would think that like there's some kind of technology like that in Star Wars.
Well, it's long ago.
Well, it's true, but they also flew. Still barely doing that.
I will say, I loved. I've read. It was Last Jedi that made me want to read some novelizations because mm-hmm. some of those characters felt a little underbaked to me. But then in the novels, they really do them justice. And I loved Laura Dern's background.
Okay.
It's fascinating. There's a reason she has violet hair. There's a reason she dresses the way she does. It's like really, really cool.
And that's the thing about fandom that I understand I'd like to get into sometimes, depending on what the franchise is. But that's the thing about Star Wars. There's endless amounts of that information. And some of it is now no longer canon, but... Even still, there's so many comic books and video games that it just goes so deep. And so people can get so passionate about so many different aspects of it. I think that's it.
Annalise, did you...
kind of material that's being generated, but like, you know, every film has a visual dictionary and an art of book, and then you get to see all of these. Like, there's every button on every costume has a name. Things that don't even appear on screen have names, like these characters, and then they have like cult followings. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's a pretty amazing phenomenon in terms of the amount of that universe that they map out.
It's certainly more well thought out than my
life. I think these conversations also invite a reflection on fandom. And I think one of the things that's important to point out about like fandom in particular, like fandom is alchemy. It's not about whether a thing is good or bad. It is about this unique thing that happens when a person makes contact with a story. And when those two things touch, there's a kind of chemical reaction. There's like a love affair that happens. And that is subjective. It's not based on whether or not a thing is sort of good. It's based on this purely emotional, euphoric feeling of this is my true love. This is the thing that like elevates me, makes me feel wonderful, makes me want more of it. And I'm very much of the opinion of like, if you're not a fan of a thing, I am the last person on earth who's going to try to like explain to you why you should be. I love going to Disneyland. I would never drag a person to Disneyland who is not interested in going to Disneyland. They're going to have a miserable time. Mm-hmm. It is not for everybody. I am too old for the Goonies. I came out at the, I was the wrong age for the Goonies. There are people who adore that film.
Yeah, I don't care.
And I'm like, I am indifferent to the Goonies, but that does not mean that Goonies fandom isn't like sublime. It just means it's not my fandom. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the problems we get into around Star Wars fandom and particularly the kind of TLJ stuff is that, you know, people like or don't like a movie, which is exactly what it is, right? Like these mm-hmm. they are technically proficient films. I think we could look at a pretty short list of films that were like truly poorly made that like fail their purpose as media. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, with most films, we're looking at a kind of critical consensus. Things shift over time. You like it, you don't like it, it's great. But we can't actually say fandom is or isn't right. Because what a person loves, like a story that a person resonates and relates to, is just that. It becomes the thing that they love. I find people's loves and likes very infectious. So I have definitely warmed to the prequels, not that I'm going to watch them, although it has been suggested to me to watch them dubbed into other languages, and that makes the acting really delightful. So like, if you get your hands on a French dub of The Phantom Menace, I highly recommend it because it's kind of great.
What does Jar Jar
sound
like?
Although
like
really
that?
Racist accents of all the other characters also go away.
Wow.
But like I don't necessarily want to watch those films, but I love hearing those fans talk. Mm. It's wonderful to hear a person talk about a thing that they love.
What does Jar Jar sound like in French?
You know, less racist.
That's great.
The Des Moines as well. We were just like, oh.
Yeah,
that whole movie was just dripping with racism.
Yeah.
So much of it. And what's the Toydashians, the Watto character?
Yes.
Like, horribly anti-Semitic character. Like, and there was a lot in there that you're just like, George.
I feel like he just didn't know in a weird way. I feel like he was like so clueless to the world. I mean, not
that. He was very clueless. And also, you know, this is why you have review boards. I always work with folks to look at my stuff because I don't know what I'm missing. And mm-hmm. I'm so grateful when folks are like, oh yeah, don't do that.
Yeah, I have editors that just constantly cut out anti-Semitic stuff from my articles. No, I'm kidding.
He's kidding. He's Jewish.
I like you're like, I'm going to immediately preface this.
I do that a lot for him.
kidding.
He's joking.
You know, it's obviously a fan is a fan in a lot of ways. You know, people love things. They love the same things. But what have you found particular to women Star Wars fans that they love maybe more than men fans might like.
Men fans. Men Fendingtons. I will answer this question in the least gender determinist way that I can because sure. Of course, like, women is not a unitary
right.
concept.
Well, the women you've interviewed.
But I will say that there's one of the observations that I have made, and I don't know if this is as much a gender thing or if it's just like a how fandom is represented, but the women that I have talked to, the broad, diverse cross-section of women that I have talked to have expressed universally a kind of pluralism in their fandom. Sometimes prefaced with this like apologetic sort of, I'm going to be pluralistic with my fandom now. Is this okay? So where this always shows up the most is like Star Trek and Star Wars fandom, where sometimes women who are talking on film will be like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Is it okay if I say something about Star Trek? Which of course it is. Huh. And that this notion of like Star Trek versus Star Wars, right? Superman versus Batman, who will win? Like that kind of binary zero-sum game is a fanboy-created game. That's like a DC versus Marvel kind of game. And Batman, the women that I have talked to have simply not embraced that. And it's not to say there aren't plenty of women out there who I'm sure absolutely do that. But I have noticed a trend toward a lot of both-and-ism and a lot of, like, these are all the different kinds of fandoms that I hold. And my Star Trek fandom and my Star Wars fandom can live right next to each other. And I don't have to be team one thing or the other. I can kind of pick both of these things up at the same time. And I do think there's something unique to a gendered expression of fandom that we bring to that.
So it's less Neanderthal, I'm on this team, I'm on that team, men type stuff. Basically.
It's, you know, and I think there's plenty of guys who have really complex and nuanced analyses of
We're
their
dumb.
Fandom
it's
and
okay.
of characters. So, you know, this is a place where I'll say not all men. Like, I think guys get really short shrifted with the way that, like, the sort of mantle of hierarchical competitive dudeness is set up. But, you know, I have talked with, like, almost 100 women. I have never been quizzed. I have never been asked to show why I should be allowed to do this film. I've never been, you know, sort of like interrogated or interviewed, and I've never had a woman explain something to me. And I cannot be out on location filming without having an onslaught of those things happen from any cis dude who's around us filming.
Interesting.
I also bet you've never had a woman immediately eroticize your love of something. Like,
no.
I cannot tell you how many times I'm having a normal conversation with a guy who I don't know very well. And I know it as I do it that I, like, disclose that I'm into comic books.
Oh,
and immediately his whole demeanor changes. He's like, oh, we're having this kind of conversation. We're like, oh, aren't you attractive now that you're randomly into this thing?
Like, ooh, that's hot.
Yeah, it's like, well, that's not why I'm into it.
When you tell guys that you love a goofy movie, it must be game over.
That is the anecdote. Can we use this? Is this like mace? Is this like the thing you just whip out?
Yeah, that's like those Axe body spray commercials, but it's me.
Salacious fanboy.
Jaws just drop.
Yeah.
They follow you around.
Yeah.
Like a puppy.
We have like several outside the studio right now. Like,
they're wearing Max t-shirts. You know, I found out today, actually, just I was interviewing, this sounds like weirdly name droppy, but it's not, I guess it kind of is, whatever. I was interviewing Taron Killam, the former SNL guy, and he was saying that he saw Phantom Menace 13 times
wow.
in theaters when it came out. He, in retrospect, he realizes that it was not worthy of 13 times in the theater. But I was talking to my girlfriend about it. I was texting with her, and we never really spoke about The Phantom Menace, because why would we, I guess? Mm-hmm. But she told me that she, when she was a kid, and I guess she was like 13 or 14 when it came out, she had a Darth Maul poster in her bedroom that she bought with her own... Well, she got a gift certificate to Borders Books, and she used it on a Darth Maul poster.
Every part of the story is great.
I don't know. And the thing is, like, she likes all this stuff. I mean, like, she's going to Disney World with me. She's excited. She'll see all the movies with me. But, like, she wasn't, like, a super fangirl of stuff, you know? Huh. And I don't know what inspired her to get this Darth Maul poster. But I love it that she had that. And so...
That's very cool.
Yeah, and you're like, what would inspire a 13-year-old girl to have a Darth Maul poster?
Same thing that would inspire a guy.
You could also ask, what wouldn't inspire a 13-year-old girl to have a Darth Maul poster? Darth Maul is, I think, kind of objectively awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was potentially, like, you know, I think universally people, regardless of what you think of The Phantom Menace, you come away from that being like, Darth Maul, badass, right? Yeah. Like, he was a high point for a lot of folks. Sadly, that did not continue. But he's a good reason to watch the animation.
Yeah, and I think, like...
In Clone Wars and Rebels in this really great way. Sam Witwer voices him. It's pretty tremendous.
Yeah, I think, like, that, even that just opened my eyes to being like, well, she didn't have a Natalie Portman poster. I don't know if they made those, but point being like...
Yeah.
You know, there was no reason for her not to. Like, there was nothing particularly girly about Darth Maul. And as, like, a 13-year-old girl, you often have, like, boy band stuff on your wall. I feel like she had that, too.
Yeah.
Who isn't to say Darth Maul isn't kind of boy bandish?
That's true.
But this, it brings a good point, actually, which is an assumption folks often have about the series, that this is, like, 90 women talking about how much they love Princess Leia or about, like, their connection to female characters.
Right.
And I would say that, like... It's a very equal spread in terms of, like, the point of identification, the place where folks are really compelled, the number of women who connected deeply and identified deeply with guy characters is, you know, it's equal, if not, well, certainly greater to, because statistically there's just more guy characters to connect to.
Yeah.
But also that, you know, it's a story that I've heard repeatedly from women of color, that, like, Leia's whiteness and that all of the female leads' whiteness is it's a roadblock to identification, and that gender jumping is easier than race jumping when it comes to being able to see yourself in a thing. And I think it speaks to the way that we kind of code race, we code whiteness as this neutral, somehow blank slate, when in fact it is not. It's a really, like, you know, powerful and overt sort of social coding. And so, yeah, the ways in which women found themselves connecting to other characters, and the sort of symbolic characters, or characteristics of those characters.
Yeah.
It's really lovely.
Yeah. I think that, like, for me, when hearing that, I was like, in after being, you know, delighted by it and then also being shocked by it, I was a little like, there was some shame in being surprised by it. Not that I'm like, I'm going to flog myself for it, but, like, why shouldn't she have had a poster of that? Why should that surprise me?
Right. Why wouldn't she have the girl?
Yeah, like, right. Yeah. Like, why would I? And that's, like, just a subconscious, like, thing.
There's
that, though. That's bad. It's all in us, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's actually a subreddit movement to, like, bring back the prequels into good graces.
I'd be all for that.
Through memes. Like, because memes are our shared
they
language,
are super meme worthy, actually.
Yes, they are. But one of my favorites is, like, because the guy I found most exciting was General Grievous.
Mm.
And the board loves that line where he's like, General Kenobi. Like, but they like, splice that audio into clips from different movies.
You know what's funny is I happened to catch it on TV a few nights ago, the last, like, hour of Return of the Jedi. It was on TNT or something. I was flipping through the channels, which is a weird thing that I guess only old people in their 30s do, flip through channels. But it's such a silly... I love the movie. Like, straight up, I love it. But it's so silly and stupid, and I couldn't believe that people protected it like such a holy text and got so mad. I mean, Last Jedi is an incredibly made movie. You know, like, it's beautifully made, and Return of the Jedi is like these teddy bears bopping, you know, stormtroopers on the head.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Luke sword fights for 4 minutes and then gets electrocuted, and then his dad throws a bad guy away. And it's a very deeply silly movie, and I love it, but it's funny to me that people are so protective of it. And but then they, like, dismiss the prequels, which are also incredibly silly.
You know? Well, and on an analytical level, like this, the veracity with which folks will interrogate plot holes and yeah. motivations and these things, I'm just like, did you watch the original trilogy? Because, you know, you could drive a truck. Like, they made up a familial relationship midway through that busted up a love triangle. I mean, like, these were... This is not like Proust. We're not sitting down and saying, look, this story has been meticulously thought out and it's going to, like, you know, take you 8 years to read. It's space opera. You're supposed to sit down with your popcorn and be a little transported. And by that standard, the new films, I do think, far surpass on a just like cinematic level. And certainly, you know, with the technology available to them, like, our nostalgia should be there and it gets to carry us around. But, you know, it also speaks to why I'm in Looking for Leia. We're not doing content critique. We're not doing character analysis because therein lies the path to madness. and then I'll get even more death threats, right? Because I can't post about The Last Jedi. Even, like, if I were to just put those three words on Twitter right now, I guarantee you I would have, like, 50, you know, honestly, MAGAites in my mentions calling me terrible names. Mm-hmm. But also because there's just kind of, like, no right or wrong with it.
Right.
It's like, those are, you can talk about it passionately. I do think there's something super compelling about, like, why do we love a story? And what does it do for us when we love something? And what are the kind of curative powers of optimism? What role does joy play in resilience? We don't ask these questions, I think, that often. We certainly don't ask them in a documentary format. Documentary tends to be really focused on trauma. And often stories of overcoming odds, but usually we get the overcoming in the last, like, 5 minutes, and it's, you know, 80 minutes of really, really hard stuff. And we're in a moment, like, we have literal Nazis in the street right now. This is a good time, I think, to make sure that we're not splitting hairs around, did you like the prequels or not? This is a time where I'm going to be like, hey, prequel defenders, I have your back. Like, did you love those? Fantastic. Do you want to fight these Nazis with me? Let's go.
Yeah.
Because my priorities are going to be pretty focused. And I think that the global experience of loving a thing is a really powerful way to form coalition and to connect with other humans. And that's fundamentally what fandom is about, is a shared passion and love of a thing, not this sort of desire to have a war for supremacy and a kind of Highlander-esque, there can be only one, you know, true fan.
Isn't that exactly what Kelly Marie Tran's character says?
I don't know.
It totally is.
It is entirely possible that that was the thesis of the entire film. Yeah. I only saw it 10 times, so I wouldn't be able to tell you.
I also love the Highlander mention. I love that movie.
Yeah, we don't
That's
talk
my
about
fandom.
Highlander
That's
enough.
My fandom, Highlander.
We don't talk about Highlander nearly enough. Metaphors for living.
That's true.
That'll be your next documentary series.
Oh my God.
Looking for Highlander fan.
I like to think it's a smaller pool of fans, at least.
The whole documentary will be looking for fans of Highlander.
Right? Hunting for Highlander is going to be that one. We're going to have to stay with the alliterations. And
I love it. So when is Looking for Leia going to grace us? I know you had a successful fundraising campaign, and we've seen some trailers, but what's the plan?
So right now we are in post-production. This is an independently produced film. We're not affiliated with Disney or Lucasfilm. We don't have that kind of money behind us. And so we're putting it together this year. I am aiming to have it completed by the end of the year and out in early 2019. We're looking for some streaming video on demand distribution. We've got some, you know, irons and fires and trying to find the kind of perfect home for it, and look forward to being able to give updates when that news kind of comes through. And I'm incredibly curious to see what the state of Star Wars fandom will do in the months that it takes us to finish the film. Already, all of my interviews sound even more interesting and prescient than they did when I did them a few months ago. And if folks want to kind of keep up to date on it, I'm going to early on give you our social media plug. The website's lookingforleia.com, and we're at Looking for Leia on Twitter, at Looking for Leia Series, on our fledgling Instagram. I am old and trying to learn how to post with pictures, and we're going to get that Instagram. I have a fabulous and significantly younger assistant producer, Katrina Dennis, who is doing much more excellent stuff on Instagram than I can do.
You know, Katrina. So,
Actually, the last question I wanted to ask is, you mentioned not being affiliated with Disney, which is, I mean, understandable. It's an independent documentary. Has it been difficult at all? Like, have they given you any trouble, or is it just sort of, you know, blessed be on your way?
Yeah, it's been blessed be on your way, which has been great. Cool. And certainly, you know, I think I do my due diligence as a filmmaker to make sure that the powers that be understand the intention of the project. It is a part of why doing character critique and content analysis is not the theme. This is about the phenomenology of fandoms. Mm-hmm. Because IP is real, and I, as an artist myself, have a lot of respect for it. Mm-hmm. So we've operated with a high degree of transparency, which has been my intention, to make sure that folks know what we're working on. We've actually been able to license some of the original John Williams score, which cool. we recorded with singers from the Archer School for Girls. So we have this great girls a cappella group doing some of that iconic John Williams music for our score, which I just adore. And you know, those little bits are there, and we're certainly hoping to be able to include a lot of sort of fan rendered visual art and visual representations of some of the stories and themes that folks are talking about in their interviews.
That sounds amazing. I can't wait for it.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be so good. Emily, how can people find you on the internet?
Just go to twitter.com and search.
Just go to twitter.com. She's right there.
That's me.
Your homepage.
Yep. I'm the homepage. My account is Emily G Monster.
And my account is at Jordan Zacharin. You can also follow us at Fandom Files Sci-Fi on Twitter. And we don't have an Instagram. We're not that advanced.
No one wants to see photos of our faces.
That'd be just us recording every time.
That's the point of it. That's why they offered us a podcast and not a web series.
Right. Yeah. I work for a TV network, but they gave me a podcast. So that's all you need to know.
We're a couple of uggos.
Annalise, thank you so much for doing this. This was so much fun.
Hey, thank you both so much. I love talking with you. May the force be with you.
Thank you so much. You too.
And also with you.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Please hit.